Ukrainian Russian forces battled out for control of a key city in the east. This while capital Kyiv becomes a target of a fresh missile strike. North Korea conducts its largest single missile test ever after the U.S. deploys a nuke-powered aircraft carrier for 3 days of joint drills with South Korea. Plus, tragedy in Bangladesh, dozens dead, hundreds injured as a massive blaze burns through a storage facility overnight. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. As Russia's war in Ukraine grinds on, the eastern city of Severodonetsk has become the latest battle line in the conflict. Ukrainian president saying the clashes are being fought street by street. Volodymyr Zelensky says the situation remains extremely difficult in this strategic city. He says that cities in the eastern Donbas region are under constant airstrikes and artillery and missile fire, but Ukrainian forces are holding their ground. Severodonetsk is the last Ukrainian stronghold in the Lugansk region. The war in Ukraine has taken a heavy civilian toll. In the latest such fatalities, at least 11 civilians were reported killed in the Lugansk and Donetsk region and the southern city of Mykolaiv. Russian forces redeployed to eastern and southern Ukraine after pulling back from other areas, including around the capital. But missile strikes continue to rock Kyiv. At least one person was hospitalized in the latest such explosion on Sunday. Well, John Miller joined us a while ago from the site of a fresh missile attack in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, and he told us where the missiles were coming from and why.
I'm in a district of Donetsk. Last night, about 9 o'clock, the city was rocked by loud explosions. I'm at the scene right now. Now, scenes like this are nothing new in Donbass, but particularly around this area, it is new as people are walking around in disbelief about what's happened. The truth here in Donetsk is that the Ukrainian army has been shelling civilian areas and has been doing so for the last 8 years, targeting and killing its own civilians. Most people here in Donetsk say they no longer want to be part of Ukraine, and increasingly they want to join Russia, and this is one of the major reasons why, of Ukraine shelling and killing its own people. Over 10,000 people have been killed in the last 8 years. Over 100 children. A 5-year-old girl was killed just a few days ago while she was sitting in her apartment watching TV. And it's a story here that's very important to be told in order to understand this conflict. If I was a journalist standing in the west of the country now, no doubt I'd be covering Russian strikes. But here in the east, in the separatist held areas, it's Ukrainian strikes. And it's increasingly some countries, at least behind the scenes, call for negotiation or for Ukraine to cede some territory. It's very important for the people here in Donbass and the separatists here and why they rose up and why they continue to fight. It's very important for their views to be heard as well. Well, miraculously, nobody was killed in these strikes. There's reports that 10 people have been wounded and one child. It happened about 9 o'clock, so most people were in their apartments. But that's a rarity. Almost every day here, people are killed by the shelling. It's not even really a story that journalists cover every day because it's just simply part of daily life. And incredibly, in the Western media, this story is not being told. Indeed, this has been going on for the last 8 years here in Donbass. It's a reason why, one of the main reasons why the separatists rose up and continued to fight. And as I said, their views, the people here, their views, and that fact that the Ukrainian army has been killing its own people for the last 8 years, that fact needs to be borne into mind, and it's very important to tell that story in order to understand why this conflict is happening.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says that Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He was responding to a question about a U.S. decision to send new arms to Kyiv. During the interview, Putin said that Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Since the beginning of the Russian offensive in Ukraine in late February, the United States has sent several arms shipments as part of a huge $40 billion in military and financial aid to Kyiv. Russia says the U.S. is seeking to wage a proxy war by supplying unprecedented amounts of military aid to Ukraine. Time now for the news review. North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital city. In recent weeks, North Korea has test fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. Now, the latest one came just a day after South Korea and the U.S. wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. North Korea has criticized their previous joint drills as an example of Washington's continued hostile policies toward Pyongyang, despite its talk of diplomacy. So North Korea missile test and U.S. and South Korea, that's the story. Now joining me will be a couple of people, our own Jennifer Chang in Seoul, and also with us will be Andrew Leung. He's an independent political analyst joining us from Hong Kong. So Jennifer, this is the largest missile test so far by North Korea, and this is despite all the warnings from here and there, especially from the U.S., not to do that, and the U.S. itself doing what North Korea never wants to do, joint military drills with South Korea. So tell us about how South Korea has reacted to this.
Well, South Korea, of course, is alarmed because they were hoping that through their show of force with the U.S., they would be able to stop North Korea from doing these types of tests. The South Koreans just wrapped up a joint drill with the U.S., their navies, the two countries' navies, did that in the waters off Okinawa, Japan, and it involved the USS Ronald Reagan, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. And it's the first time this type of drill has taken place in about 4 years, so this was a huge show of force. But the North Koreans, instead of stopping their missile tests, they went ahead and did their biggest so far, involving 8 short-range ballistic missiles. And this, of course, has the South Koreans and the Japanese alarmed. The Japanese defense minister said it was an unprecedented missile test. Mm-hmm. And this follows very shortly after the May 25th test in which North Korea fired 3 ballistic missiles, including an ICBM, the Hwasong-17, which can nuke the U.S. mainland, as well as their KN-23, which can nuke South Korea. So that had been considered the biggest missile test so far. That involved 3 ballistic missiles, but now we have 8 ballistic missiles. Right. And it's just getting worse and worse here, the tensions because of the U.S. and the U.S.'s insistence on trying to make the North not do any tests through shows of force with South Korea.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for that. Now, Andrew, let us know your opinion about what's going on, really, because we have the two sides accusing each other of provoking the other side. I mean, North Korea says that do not conduct your military drills, get your force out of the region, don't do this. The West does it, the U.S. in particular I'm talking about. And then we have the U.S. Warning North against testing more missiles. And the North says that this is deterrence. We have to do it. So who's provoking who?
Well, as I said on this panel so many times, that the North Koreans have completely lost interest, let alone confidence, in the so-called talks led by the United States, because the United States always wants to have it all without giving anything. As any, even the minimum concession right at the beginning. Secondly, the North Koreans are now, I think, completely hooked on the idea that it's better to develop their own nuclear deterrence and also the missile delivery systems. And of course, the immediate reaction is against this quite large-scale military exercises right at its front door. So in a way, this is a warning against the United States and South Korea. But on the other hand, the North Koreans are taking advantage of this, the present situation, whereby the United States is increasingly distracted in over Ukraine and also domestically all sorts of problems. And then, of course, the the main agenda is kind of anti-China strategies. So the North Koreans are taking advantage of this to perfect their missile delivering systems. So that's what we're seeing. I mean, this is a typical security spiral where one side doesn't trust another, and each side is upping up the ante, leading to a worsening situation.
Mm-hmm. And Jennifer, it's what about the people? I mean, the governments, they have their own reasons, and they take action rightly or wrongly. What about the people of the two Koreas? How do they feel about this?
Well, of course, the people of the two Koreas are getting alarmed by all this tension. The last thing they want is another Korean War, because it was the civilians of both Koreas that bore the brunt, the casualties and the deaths in the Korean War. And this current South Korean president is far too hawkish for many South Koreans. He barely won the presidential election here by just 0.73%. And his competitor has already been elected a lawmaker. So this is despite the, you know, presidential election defeat. And the South Koreans, you never know when they are going to turn on the Korean president for being too hardline. He's very new. He just started his term on May 10th, and he has five long years ahead of him. Mm-hmm. And if tensions continue to rise like this, we could see a backlash from the South Korean voters.
Uh-huh. Andrew, let's have your forecast for future. You mentioned lack of trust from both sides. And then we have North Korea talking about thinking of defending itself. So they say this is necessary to do, despite the U.S. Condemning it. And then we have this, the new president in South Korea, as Jennifer was mentioning. So given all the situation and circumstances, is denuclearization possible on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, I don't think that there is any immediate chance of denuclearizing with the deepening mistrust between the United States and North Korea. But as far as North Korea is North Korea, but South Korea's politics, as pointed out by your other speaker, is also complicated, because apart from this kind of rhetoric, a saber rattling against North Korea, which is its neighbor, this doesn't sit well with the South Korean electorate, because they want a peaceful life. They don't want to invade North Korea and force a unification on South Korean terms. That's simply not practicable. And also, this kind of drills between the United States and South Korea is not only directed at North Korea, but directed to China. Now, China, of course, is the South Korea's biggest trading partner. And there is a great deal of investments, South Korean investments in China. China is now also buying a lot of semiconductor products from South Korea. And that helps, that's a great boost to South Korea's economy. So this kind of rhetoric, saber rattling, threatening its largest trading partner, which is China, and its neighbor, North Korea, is extremely problematic as far as the South Korean voters are concerned. But that's the new president is dancing to the tune of the United States. But as pointed out, I mean, he would discover very soon that it's not very good politics.
Okay, thank you so much for the contribution input. Jennifer Chang, a correspondent in Seoul. Andrew Leung, independent public analyst in Hong Kong. Welcome back. Let's move on. Turkey is gearing up for another major incursion into northern Syrian territory despite international outcry. Ankara has launched several offensives already in the war-ravaged Arab country, and that under the pretext of fighting Kurdish militants there. But this time, Turkey's ties with the U.S. and Russia are at stake.
Tensions are once again rising in northern Syria as Turkey threatens to conduct a major military operation there. Ankara says it wants to establish a 30-kilometer safe zone along the Syrian border and push back terrorists. Turkey has long been fighting members of the People's Protection Units, YPG, a U.S.-backed Kurdish militia it deems a terrorist group. Since 2016, Turkey has carried out three major incursions inside the Syrian territory under the same pretext, the latest of which came in October 2019, which fell short of ending in creating the buffer zone Ankara was hoping for. In the meantime, Damascus has slammed the Turkish plan as an act of aggression and an extension of Ankara's policy of ethnic cleansing in the area.
Turkey has been notorious for smuggling oil and engaging in oil theft in Syria. It has been launching military operations into Syria. It is indeed shot down and killed Russian military members in Syria. So Turkey has ambitions to expand its political footprint and reconquer parts of Syria that it lost after World War I in the Sykes-Picot Act, which the French and the British carved up the Middle East after World War I.
Syria says the measures taken by Turkey have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages.
Death toll from a fire and explosion at a shipping container depot in Bangladesh has hit 34. At least 300 others have also been injured, some critically. Casualty figures are expected to rise as firefighters are still trying to bring the flames under full control. The blaze broke out late Saturday at a container storage facility in a town some 40 kilometers from the key port city of Chittagong. Emergency crews were working to extinguish the fire when a massive explosion rocked the site. And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
departure.
Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the history of Qasr edifice, the story of a museum that has had so many ups and downs, dependent to the different utilization of the place. The journey from a luxurious palace, which was converted to a dreadful political prison and is now a museum. The story of the Qasr edifice is intertwined with some of the most turbulent and crucial years of Iran's history. And within the confines of its walls, it holds countless memories of suffering and struggle. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the documentary.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Qasr prison.
During the time the prison was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example, to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's why some families knew their children were there.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savvak brutality. In hindsight, Savvak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davud Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Qasr prison. Now he's working as a guide at the Garden Museum.
Savak's harassment and torture accelerated the downfall of the Shah, and the Iranian people became stronger and stronger, and continued the struggle to overthrow the decadent regime.
In 1974, student activities intensified and street demonstrations flared up. With draconian power, Savak set a reign of terror that lasted 2 years. Many were arrested, tortured, or even killed on the slightest charges. This era was one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern Iran.
در سال 55 رژیم شاه تصمیم داشت.
In 1976, the regime had decided to put in prison whoever showed the least opposition, thinking that in this way it could reduce the numbers of its opponents. Therefore, the prisons of the Shah became overcrowded, that is, political prisons. At that time, the Qasr prison and others were overcrowded.
Inside prisons, clerics would shoulder a special burden to teach young prisoners and broaden their horizons.
Prominent religious scholars like Ayatollah Talaghani and others tried to attract other people rather than to reject them. Even a person who had caved in a little to Savak torture would get ablaze when associated with such great people.
Savak, long suspicious of clerics' activities in prisons and afraid of their success, began to hold them back.
Up to the year 1974, the circumstances were desirable for political prisoners because there was no separation between them. For example, Mr. Talaghani and other prominent figures were all in the same prison, with a young man sentenced to a few months for distributing communiques. Such a man would mix with them and get trained by them. The political prison had become the university of the revolution. But after the year 1974, most of the religious scholars were transferred to Evin Penitentiary, to a place specifically for religious scholars in order to disconnect their relations with other prisons so as to prevent them from growing.
Identifying different political and ideological currents in prisons and sowing discord among prisoners were on the list of SAVAK's priorities. The main aim was to pit opposition leaders against one another, tarnish their reputations and drain them of power so they couldn't fight the regime.
What is SAVAK?
SAVAK itself would provoke prisoners to discuss with each other and pit them against each other. So it was probable that a problem would rise between those people, and the winner was SAVAK. So to avoid such a thing inside prison, the prisoners tried to keep their unity, saying, "We have a common enemy, and in front of this common enemy, we have to be united and must not provide SAVAK with excuses."
By arresting political dissidents, SAVAK aimed to quench the raging flames of the revolution. But since almost all political prisoners were transferred to Tehran, the prisons became a hive of political activity. The prisoners were filled in on the latest gossip, news, or instructions and announcements issued by Ayatollah Khomeini by their families, who would visit them from every corner of the nation.
The best point of this prison had to do with meetings. A long, narrow corridor, a wall about 1 meter in height, with rails and nettings, and a distance of 1 meter with officers in between.
When they came here, they would stand behind bars, prisoners on this side. Imagine such a large number of visitors who wanted to talk to prisoners all at the same time in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, all of them wanted to talk and tell their things. How was it possible for them to do so in 10 minutes? That's while some prisoners and families had to exchange political information from inside and outside the prison.
Mr. Mansouri believes political prisoners have always been well informed about the country's affairs.
After all, political prisoners would try regularly to be up to date and have the best analysis of the issues. It may be interesting to know that we in prison knew much more about the country's issues than those who were outside prison. The reason was that, besides studying and discussing, those families who came to see their children would give them information from all over the country, and this information would come into prison.
Drunk with absolute power, the Shah of Iran gave SAVAK more leeway to oppress any opposition. No matter how hard political parties struggled, the prospect looked grim. From 1975, SAVAK stopped releasing political prisoners, even after serving their sentences.
At that time, freedom had no meaning for the political prisoner, even for a person who had finished his term in prison. There are many examples of this case who had finished their terms in prison in 1977, but they were not released from prison.
One week before their release, they would be transferred to Evin Penitentiary, and on their release days, they were forced to sign their detention papers. After serving their time, their families were waiting for them on their release days. They would be counting the days for their release. But not only were they not released on the day, but also they were given a detention paper to sign and held in Evin Penitentiary. What's the significance of Evin? In Evin, there was no visit. The families lost touch with the prisoners again.
In those days, the Shah was the cruelest dictator in the Middle East, and reports on human rights in Iran were disappointing. But since the US didn't put pressure on its Iranian ally, the Shah never admitted the deplorable conditions in his country.
You're saying you do what every country does.
Sure.
If torture is necessary, you torture. not the torture in the old sense of torturing people, twisting their arms and doing this and that. But there are intelligent ways of questioning now.
Well, they talk about psychological and physical torture.
Physical, I don't believe.
I talked...
Not anymore. Maybe in the old days, maybe.
I talked just today to a man whom I believe who told about torture.
He was tortured?
Yes.
And you believe that he was tortured?
Yes.
How many years ago?
Within, I want to be very careful, not yesterday.
Ah, well, maybe. I don't know.
The word has gone out to stop it.
To stop what?
Torture.
But a long time ago, yes.
Until 1976, the Shah was a despot, a ruthless man with everything at his disposal. Above all, the country's wealth. That year, the Republicans in the US stepped down from power. The Shah had spent the country's petrodollars on his favorite candidate, Gerald Ford. But in the end, the young Jimmy Carter, with his slogan of human rights, was sworn in as the new president of the United States.
To human rights must be absolute. But let no one confuse our idealism with weakness. Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
During the U.S. presidential elections, in order to earn a domestic and international reputation, the Democratic nominee announced his decision over abiding by human rights because his predecessors didn't do that at all. They were Republican, abrasive, belligerent, and suppressive. When they came to power, they asked all the dictators who were U.S. pawns to open political space and improve the image of the U.S.
The Shah of Iran made a U-turn on political freedom and an attempt to win favor with the new U.S. president. As a result, the Savak's harassment reduced and political activities increased.
It was decided that international organizations like the Red Crescent, Amnesty International, the Human Rights Organization, to visit the country's prisons, the political prisons. The Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee had a torture chamber. They quickly put some shelves in the torture chamber and converted it into a library. They put the books they had taken from us there to tell the international organizations that they had a library in the prison.
With this democratic gesture, the Shah aimed to ameliorate the situation and persuade the White House to sell him arms. Both Carter and the Shah rested assured that with the Savak and the most powerful army in the region, an open political space would never put the regime in danger.
The U.S. Senate had asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Cyrus Vance, "Mr. Vance, if political freedom in Iran leads to the downfall of the Shah, you will be held responsible." Vance said that they would abide by human rights as far as U.S. national interests were safe.
In the end, opening a political space, rather than diffusing the situation, helped the opponents hold demonstrations, deliver speeches, and attack Savak for its crimes on an unprecedented scale.
Anyway, as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the US had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government, but in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before. The US didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
Since SEVAK had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple unarmed activities.
On October the 24th, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not the false benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Weeks later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qass prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and SEVAK agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qass prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garda Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qass prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qass Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favorite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude. But when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qass Garden Museum is a national place, and its programs must be national and distinguished, and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Ras Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place. That's due to the breadth of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. A witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.
Well, with the drastic changes the edifice witnessed in the past 200 years, one can only wonder what will become of it 200 years from now. And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Right, so the world is often a suckish place, right? I personally stopped listening to the news a very long time ago, but still, it's evident. We can see that a lot of the horrible things that happen in this world is because human beings, some of them, tend to be selfish and greedy. And that leads to a lot of chaos and oppression and makes life harder for those who've been exploited and usurped and robbed than it necessarily has to be. Yeah, sure, life is hard, things happen, it is what it is, I get that. But that does not justify any of us to push our limits, you know, push our limits in a bad way, in a way that would infringe other people's rights to get what we want. I personally believe most, if not all, the problems we face in life, and most, if not all, the problems that are occurring in the world is because of greediness. And also, geese die. What do I mean? Let's listen to the anecdote.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear friends, we have a nice story for this part. Thank you very much for listening to Lantern. This story entitled The Goose and the Golden Egg. There was once a countryman who possessed the most wonderful goose you can imagine for every day. When he visited the nest, the goose had laid a beautiful, glittering golden egg. The countryman took the eggs to market and soon began to get rich, but it was not long before he grew impatient with the goose because she gave him only a single golden egg a day. He was not getting rich fast enough. Then one day, after he had finished counting his money, the idea came to him that he could get all the golden eggs at once by killing the goose and cutting it open. But when the deed was done, not a single golden egg did he find. And his precious goose was dead. Yes, those who have plenty want more and so lose all they have.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Ambition is okay as long as I rely on my ethical effort and the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to support me. And then when things don't necessarily go according to my plan, I am able to tell myself that this is probably my rizq. This is probably what Allah is satisfied with me having. And if I try to gain anything beyond this, it means that I'm not content with the will of God, and it might even lead me to usurping the right of others. And that's what greedy people do, basically. And that's why it's wrong. I said that it's such a huge insult to God because, well, it means that I'm not happy with what God has given me. And it's so funny to have that sort of mentality because you never objected to all the other stuff he gave you. I mean, I lived my life 20-something years and I never objected to the fact that, I have eyes and ears and a mouth and limbs and body that works properly, and I'm healthy, and I've got a roof over my head, and I've got a bed to sleep on at night, and I have food, and I have a job, and I have family members, and I have pets, and I have a good life. I never objected to that. But once I have my eyes on something that perhaps even belongs to someone else, and I don't get it, I start having beef with God and trying to use whatever means possible to reach that objective. And that's uncool, right? The other problem with greediness is that, well, it just defeats the purpose of everything. A person who's greedy and who's not content with what they have, not only are they opposing the will of God, but they are violating all the red lines that are there which prevents the community from turning into an absolute anarchy. We think we've got democracy, and we think we are sophisticated, and we think we are civilized, but at the core of it all, when we're greedy and we're not happy with what we have and what God has willed for us, or what the universe has given us, whatever school of thought we follow, we will allow ourselves to display any sort of behavior to get what we want. And that, well, that just turns us into a toddler, doesn't it? And society will not survive, and it has not survived, and that's why everything has gone south since forever, because some of us have this sort of mindset, and it's ridiculously tragic, and it's ridiculously sad. Obviously, no one who's greedy on a global scale is listening to this show, so I'm just reminding myself first and foremost, and whoever else that stumbles upon this segment, that chill, you guys, just chill. It's very important for us to find the line between ambition and greediness, and it's most definitely important for us to be content with what we have and be grateful for what we have. These are few life hacks in order for us to avoid being greedy, is to be grateful for the things that we have and try to highlight them rather than highlighting the things that we don't have. Because when we highlight the things that we don't have, we become bitter and we become malicious toward people who do have it, and we turn into ill-wishers that aren't happy with our lives, aren't happy with other people's happiness, aren't happy with God, aren't happy with anything. Especially if we don't have the tools and means to get that thing that the other person has, oh, then we're going to be such miserable people. But if we could just settle down and be cool and be happy with the one golden egg that we have every day, and if we could just, even maybe sometimes on a good day, venture as far as to share that one golden egg with other people, then imagine what a merry place this world would be. I know it's easier said than done. I know that I still have a very long way to go to practice this sort of mindfulness and gratitude for the big and little things that I already have, and to be able to look beyond myself and my own individual needs and maybe share what I have with other people. Like the Quran says in Surah Al-Yasin, where the believers tell the non-believers to give to the needy, their response is, do we give to those whom even Allah has deprived them? And then they continue by saying that, are you guys out of your minds? You see this sort of malicious, miserable mindset? How self-centered do we have to be to think like that about one another? But inshallah ta'ala, little steps at a time. Take the time to maybe jot down the little things or the big things that made us happy today, and try to practice gratitude and mindfulness and just sitting in the now, in the present moment, like Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam says, so we can better appreciate the things that we have. And like we said, highlight the things that we do have rather than the things that we don't. And we'll just automatically become happier, and we won't cut open our goose and kill it. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul
qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.